As an American born 1 year after this film came out, I don't have a full appreciation for the never-ending story. I never got super into it. It was something that I saw on snatches on basic cable broadcasts. However, the film does have lots of memorable imagery, so bits and pieces stuck with me through osmosis. I knew enough to understand pop culture references made to the film on The Simpsons or The Venture Brothers, but I didn't watch this all the way through until I was in my early 20s. But yeah, Neverending Story is a big deal, especially outside of the United States, and it has a lot of stuff going on in its subtext, even beyond the off-sided instances of traumatizing death scenes. You know, they cut to Bastian sobbing immediately after the horse goes under. Wolfgang Petersen knew what he was doing with that sequence and what it was going to do to the people watching the film. Anyways, we'll be talking about that bit, and lots of other stuff. My name is Ryan, this is a real deep dive. Alright, we got another loaded camp for this one. We got my sister Cheryl.
Hello!
This was Cheryl's pick. The main reason Cheryl picked this is because she really, really wanted Toby to watch this for some reason. Hi, Toby.
Hello. Yay. I liked this.
Alright, and also on board is Pete.
Hello!
And Senti's back.
Ahoy, hoy!
And Sarah's here.
Hi.
Yeah, we're sharing three mics, so we're gonna do the best we can. Before I get into the plot recap, anybody have some, like, immediate after-movie hot takes they want to throw out?
This movie was amazing. It was my first time watching that type of movie. It was a very fun movie. The graphics were different from what I'm used to. And I think we all can agree that Falcor is the best character.
I watched this movie for the first time at 35, and it's a trip.
Yeah, you don't say.
This movie was a regular watch for me all throughout my childhood. I've probably seen it like 100 times. It's still awesome.
I agree.
So you didn't fall off the wagon with your 98th viewing? You're just like, eh, it sucks now.
No, this was definitely not a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3 for me, which turned on me. It betrayed me.
I first saw this movie when I was very young. I was born in 81. We didn't have a VCR until I was probably like 7 or 8, so I'm guessing I saw it around that age. But that stupid dog, Gamork, haunted me as a child.
Yeah, I can believe that. How about you, Sarah? You have any hot takes on Neverending Story?
I think I might be the only one here who doesn't actually like the movie that much. I saw it the first time when I was 21, I think, and I fell asleep.
You know, a lot of the negative reviews when this film came out called it a sleeping pill for children, so, hey.
Hold on, called my mom a child.
I need to point out the craziness of this. To this day, I still think it's weird that Sarah doesn't love this movie, because knowing her, it's a movie that tells you how awesome books are, and the protagonist's best friend is a dog.
I know, by all accounts, I should really like this movie, but I think I was just too old when I watched it the first time, and it did not hook me.
I mean, the graphics...
You love a lot of crazy fantasy shit, particularly from the 80s.
I do. It's true. I also, for some reason, I know they're not the same movie, but they sort of meld together in my head, this and that one with Macaulay Culkin.
Pagemaster!
Yeah, because that's what he literally goes into the book, right?
Yeah, I was never into the Pagemaster. Anyways, plot recap. We open with 10-year-old Bastian Bucks, who is a shy and outcast bibliophile, living with his widowed father. One day on his way to school, Bastian is chased by bullies but escapes by hiding in a bookstore, annoying the bookseller, Mr. Coriander. Yes, he's named after the spice. Bastian's interest in books leads him to ask about the one that Coriander is reading, but the bookseller advises against reading it, saying it is not a safe story like regular books. With his curiosity piqued, very much by design, Bastian secretly takes the book, titled The Neverending Story, leaving a note promising to return it, and hides in his school's attic. He's ditching a math test to read it. Now, Charles' take is that Bastian is a cruel thief, but the film clearly codes it that Bastian was meant to take that book. That bookseller was just like, hi, here's a sexy, awesome book that you're not allowed to read, small child. I'm gonna put it on the corner within your reach, and then I'm gonna go leave and take this phone call. Don't take it!
Okay, but if I was 12 and I walked into the bookstore and I stole Anne Rice novels because they were well outside my reading level because they're full of porn, I'm pretty sure that I would have been in trouble and a Thief, and I shouldn't have been allowed to read that book.
Haunted Bookkeeper was smiling as the kid was taking that book. He knew what was up.
He had like a Tales from the Crypt kind of grin on his face.
Yeah, got another one. The book describes the fantasy world of Fantasia slowly being devoured by a malevolent force called the Nothing. The childlike empress who rules Fantasia has fallen ill, and the young warrior Atreyu is tasked to discover a cure, believing that once the empress is well, the Nothing will no longer be a threat. Atreyu is giving him a medallion called the Auron that can guide and protect him in this quest. And as he sets out, the Nothing summons a vicious and highly intelligent wolf-like creature called Gamork and sends him to kill him. Atreyu's quest directs him to the giant turtle-like advisor Morla, the Ancient One, in the Swamps of Sadness. Though the Auron protects Atreyu, his beloved horse Artax is lost in the swamp, and he continues alone. Morla won't help Atreyu because he's allergic to youth, but reluctantly directs him to the Southern Oracle, 10,000 miles distant, before going back to Eternal Nap. Gamork closes in as Atreyu succumbs to exhaustion trying to escape the swamps, but is narrowly saved by the luck dragon Falcor. Falcor takes him to the home of two gnomes who live near the gates of the Southern Oracle. Atreyu crosses the first gate, but is perplexed when the second gate, a mirror that shows the viewer's true self, reveals a boy named Bastion who is reading the book. Atreyu eventually meets the Southern Oracle, who tells him that the only way to save the Empress is to find a human child who lives beyond the boundaries of Fantasia to give her a new name. Atreyu and Falcor flee as Nothing consumes the Southern Oracle. In flight, Atreyu is knocked from Falcor's back into the Sea of Possibilities, losing the Auron in the process. He awakens on the shore of some abandoned ruins, where he finds several murals depicting his adventure thus far. He then spots a mural of Gamork, in which Gamork reveals himself.
I want to interrupt you really quickly, just because I know you're the only other person who actually read, like, any Arthurian legends. Do you remember which knight walked into a similar location, and then it was a tomb, but, like, his future tomb?
Percival, maybe?
Oh, that makes sense. Sorry, that was driving me insane.
I'm guessing. I'm going to have to look that up later. Anyways, Gamork reveals that Fantasia represents humanity's imagination and is thus without boundaries, while the Nothing is a manifestation of the loss of hopes and dreams. Gamork then attacks Atreyu, but is killed. However, the Nothing begins to consume the ruins themselves. Falcor manages to retrieve the Auron and rescue Atreyu, but the two find themselves in a void with only small fragments of Fantasia remaining. Fearing that they failed, they eventually spot the Empress's tower among the fragments. Inside, Atreyu approaches the Empress and apologizes for failing her, but she assures him that he has succeeded in bringing to her a human child who has been following his quest. And hey, it's Bastion. She further explains that just as Bastion is following Atreyu's story, others are following Bastion's, making this part of the never-ending story. As the Nothing begins to consume the tower, the Empress explains that Bastion must call out her new name in order to save Fantasia. Disbelieving that he has been incorporated into the story, Bastion denies that these events are actually happening. He gives in, however, after she pleads directly to him to call out her new name. He runs to the window of the attic and screams, "Moonchild." Bastion awakens with the Empress, who presents him with a grain of sand, the sole remaining fragment of Fantasia. The Empress does tell Bastion that he has the power to bring Fantasia back with his imagination, which he does, recreating it, and as Bastion flies on Falcor's back to see the land and its inhabitants restored, including Atreyu and Artax. When Falcor asks what his next wish will be, Bastion brings Falcor to the real world in order to chase down those school bullies and make them flee into the dumpster.
Can I just say something real quick? That is my second favorite part of that movie, and it's just because of the fact that the luck dragon is... Well, Auntie Rue made this joke at the beginning of the movie where it's like, he doesn't eat people. Falcor doesn't eat people, but they're good for breakfast. And so that joke kind of tied on to the part where Falcor is chasing those bullies from the beginning of the movie into the garbage can thingy.
The film's concluding narrator mentions that Bastion had many more wishes and adventures in him, but that's another story. Alright, The Neverending Story is adapted from a 1979 novel of the same name, at least in its English translation, by German fantasy author Michael Ende. It first reached American shores in 1983, the year before the film came out. Famously, amongst people who are into this sort of thing, the movie adapts only the first half of the book. After Bastion saves the day, he remains in the kingdom to use his wish powers to rebuild it. However, the catch is that, whenever he uses a wish, Bastion loses a memory of the outside world. Soon enough, he forgets everything about his former reality except a memory of his father and his own name. Ultimately, Bastion becomes a character in the Neverending Story, setting things up for whoever reads the book next. Initial printings of the Neverending Story were done in red and black ink to distinguish events that took place in reality and events that took place in the mystical world of Fantastica.
That sounds like a Scrooge McDuck villain.
Wait, I have a question.
And yet they went with a far less Disney name of Fantasia.
So my question is, in the book, you said that it sets it up for the Neverending Story to continue. Does that mean that it ends with Bastion never leaving Fantasia?
Yeah, Bastion becomes a fictional character in the world of Fantasia, and you yourself are the next person to be sucked into the book.
I feel bad for his horrible father.
Well, I just assume that means that Bastion is writing fanfiction now.
You wouldn't be wrong on that.
The success of the novel motivated Warner Brothers to snap up the film rights and give the production a $27 million budget, the heftiest price tag ever given to a film made outside of the United States or the Soviet Union to that period. The initial director, Helmut Dietl, was immediately overwhelmed by the complexity of what the shoot would entail. He had never worked on anything with all the mechanical puppets, pyrotechnics, green screen, makeup effects, and so on that this would demand. Wolfgang Petersen, who had just come off the hit submarine war movie Das Boot, was looking to make something a little less bleak for his next project. He also had an 11-year-old son, and he was reaching that point where, like, he wanted to make something that his kid could watch and be like, hey, I made that. Because, you know, 11-year-olds probably aren't super into Das Boot. So he enthusiastically signed on. Ande was initially pleased about the prospect of a Neverending Story film. He thought it had a great deal of potential for a live-action film. He sold the film to Warner Brothers for $50,000 when he could have gotten a fair bit more. But he soon felt betrayed by the many revisions made to his baby. There's lots of little stuff that got changed. Atreyu has green skin in the book. And there's lots of big stuff, such as ignoring the second half of the entire damn book. Petersen, knowing that Ande was dismayed, flew out to Rome to try to workshop the script with him personally, but it didn't work out. Ande was obstinate when Petersen detailed the difficulties in squeezing the source material into a 94-minute running time, and also within the limits of special effects technology of 1984. Ultimately, Petersen and Warner Brothers went to work without Ande's involvement. Ande demanded that Warner Brothers either halt production of the film entirely or change the name of the film. He then sued the studio when they refused, and he lost.
Oof.
Ande ultimately called the film a gigantic melodrama of kitsch, commerce, plush, and plastic.
Harsh.
Yeah.
I disagree with him. He deserved what he got that he lost, because that is not right. I mean, how can you do that in 1984, in a 94-minute period? Like, have an entire, like, what, 200, 300-page book into, like, 3-4 hours?
Generally speaking, I tend to side with the artist. I believe that they have a right to dictate how their creation is released and accepted and distributed throughout the community. I think they have certain rights that larger companies often exploit because they just have more lawyers on deck. I don't think The Neverending Story is a bad movie. I think it's a better world for having this movie in it, at least in some kind of small way. But yeah, at the same time, it's a bummer that Ande wasn't happy with this.
It's like hearing about Mary Poppins for the first time. You're like, oh no.
That killed me a little bit when I found that out.
Because they couldn't work the second half of the entire novel into the movie, they started shooting The Neverending Story without a proper ending. Petersen essentially wrote the luck dragging chasing the bullies into the dumpster bit more or less on the fly.
Well, I liked it.
So Toby, your favorite part was improv.
It was still the best part, alright? You can't change my mind about that. Yeah, I loved it.
Improv with a giant puppet that takes like 6 people to pilot is really impressive.
Okay, yeah. It what do you mean by on the fly is like on the fly in the script. When they filmed it, it wasn't like 30 seconds before they were done doing the production.
There are instances where they start shooting a movie when the script isn't completely done. Most of the time it doesn't turn out well. Lethal Weapon 4, for example. Anyways, Neverending Story was mostly shot at Stage 1 of the Bavaria Studios in Munich, with outdoor scenes photographed in Vancouver. The beach scene, where Atreyu sinks, was filmed in San Jose, Almeria, Spain. The shoot was apparently uncomfortable because it was the hottest German summer in about 25 years. There were instances over the shoot. Noah Hathaway, who plays Atreyu, he took the part after he turned down starring in a Gene Kelly and Margaret production of the musical Chaplin. He thought the Neverending Story was a better part for him. He was almost wounded or killed multiple times. The horse threw him off and stepped on him. His leg got caught during the Swamp of Sadness scene, and he got pulled underwater and lost consciousness. And the Gamork robot almost gouged his eye out with his teeth. They only got one take of that fight. I mean, I do think it's to Peterson's credit that after the wolf puppet almost gored his star, he's like, let's not do another take of that. The makeup team tried to paint Hathaway green, but everyone agreed that it wasn't working. Tammy Stronach, who was the child empress, she had lost her two front teeth shortly before the shoot and had to wear false ones.
Is that why she has such a weird accent?
No, that's probably the dubbing.
Oh my gosh, so much dubbing in this movie.
Yeah, almost every character in the fantasy sequences got redubbed, either because they were a puppet, or they were a German actor, or because they just didn't like the sound of the kid's voice. Noah Hathaway, in general, has a rather high voice and a completely different accent than the person that they dubbed in, as does the child empress.
So the child empress's voice wasn't actually her?
Almost nobody in this movie is actually using their real voice.
Well, I feel better now.
After the rough cut was produced, Wolfgang Peterson asked Steven Spielberg for advice on how to tighten up the film and make it more accessible to a wider audience. Spielberg jumped on for an uncredited edit job, cutting about 7 minutes out of the movie. Peterson thanked him by giving him the original Oren pendant. Spielberg keeps it in his office to this day.
Aww.
It's not fair. Spielberg already has all of the cool things. He doesn't need more cool things.
But imagine the auction someday when he dies at like 120, because we need to keep that man in the world.
And because he's being protected by the Oren.
Alright, it's time to talk about this movie's music. The score is by Klaus Doldinger of the German jazz group Passport. It's fairly traditional score. Parts of it were punched up for the American release by Giorgio Moroder, the synth-pop disco king. You can usually notice when his contributions are coming to the forefront. Generally, there's more synthesizer. When Atreyu is sinking into the swamp. When anyone is writing Falcor. If you hear keyboards, that's the Moroder bit. At the time, Giorgio Moroder had been doing scores for lots of big hit movies. One could say that 80s soundtracks were just permanently altered by Giorgio Moroder. He was the big hot producer at the time. So if a movie was going to make money, it was going to have some Moroder keyboard in it.
Theme song, theme song, theme
song, theme song, theme song.
Yeah, the theme song was composed by Giorgio Moroder with lyrics by Keith Forsey. It was sung by Christopher Hamill of the group Kajagoogoo.
Say that name again.
Stop.
Christopher Hamill.
You know what you...
Wait, my whole life I thought that song was sung by a woman.
There is a female backup singer.
Yeah, but I thought the main singer was a woman.
The inside joke is still going and we're in the podcast now, guys. Come on.
I told Toby we're watching it. If any older people, particularly boomers, start taunting like musical artists of his generation and saying that nobody has a good names anymore, just mention that someone in 1984 thought that they should call themselves Kajagoogoo and they actually had charting hits with that name.
Wow, I'm honestly surprised.
The Neverending Story theme song intentionally fades in and out with no clear start or end. It was not used in the European edit of the film, but is in the American version, and apparently the Japanese version.
So, to be clear, the Japanese version I had, the opening theme was there, but then it was just overdubbed in Japanese, but you could watch it in English as well.
Despite its spotty presentation, it peaked at number 4 on the UK charts. It stalled out in the United States, but ultimately climbed to number 17 after the movie started playing on TV. And it is apparently everybody's favorite movie theme song.
That's because it's a solid bop.
It's a very good theme song.
Gets stuck in your head forever and you don't mind.
Theme song.
Also, Stranger Things.
Yes.
Yes.
Warner Brothers was planning to have Supergirl be their big 1984 blockbuster tentpole release, but creative differences with the filmmakers and the bad reception of Superman 3 led Warner Brothers to let TriStar distribute Supergirl, so they went all in on Neverending Story. 1984 turned out to be something of a competitive year for high-concept, effects-driven tentpole releases. Neverending Story was competing alongside Ghostbusters, Karate Kid, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Star Trek III, Search for Spock, Conan the Destroyer, The Last Starfighter, and the Olympics.
Dang!
I've seen all of those except for the last one, and I was really excited. Movie night?
Wait, the Olympics you haven't seen?
Yeah, we didn't go back and watch the 1984 Olympics. Neverending Story was a flop in the United States, taking in only $20 million. That being said, it more than made up for that in other countries. 5 million German people bought a ticket to the movie, which had never happened before. Ultimately, the Neverending Story made $100 million in box office revenue total. Peterson blamed the frosty American reception on the movie's European sensibilities, whatever the hell that means.
That's offensive. That's discrimination.
Maybe because it has fantasy stuff in it.
I've never been to Europe, but if Europe is full of, like, giant head rock monsters, I'm going now.
I hate to break it to you, but I didn't see any giant rock head monsters.
I mean, everyone talks about the horse drowning as the most traumatic event in the film. To me, the most affecting scene is when the giant rock guy is looking at his hands, saying that they're good, strong hands.
They look like good, strong hands.
I had that turn. Childhood for me, it was the horse, but then watching as an adult, I'm like, no, I get you, Rockman.
Yes, yeah, I understand that. Like, I guess I'll just sit here and let nothing take me to.
Everyone, including myself, agrees that the Rockman needs to be loved. He is the Rockman. He is the true Rockman.
All right, I should probably go over the cast for this. We have Barrett Oliver as Bastion.
Who?
Who the hell is that?
I thought he did a good job.
No, he did a good job. Has he been in anything else?
Not so much. Most of the people in this movie don't really have much of a resume outside of it. Generally speaking, my standards for child actors is, does this kid annoy me? And he does not.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah, he has good interactions with the Empress, and even that one scene with his dad where he's drinking the blended raw eggs.
That dad's got a weird diet.
All right, then we have Noah Hathaway as Atreyu, who's really the star of this movie. I mean, hard to say because he's not using his actual voice, but I do think that his body language and his facial expressions are nice.
You can see the sadness when the horse is sinking.
Yeah, he was one of my early childhood crushes. Every one of my early childhood crushes had long hair, though.
Oh, yeah, I was like, was it the floppy hair that did it for you?
Yeah, because, you know, I was like a gay in disguise. It was my gateway.
We have Tammy Stonark as the Empress / Moonchild. She was training to be a dancer. She essentially quit movies immediately after this one because she's a stage performer.
I mean, she looks like a dancer. I can see that.
Yeah, and all these people that I've discussed so far are now currently in their early 50s, and they seem to be doing okay.
Good for them.
We have Patricia Hayes as Urgle and Sidney Bromley as Angiwook. Those were the two gnomes.
Willow!
For Hayes in particular, just like she should show up in every movie. She should be the butler in Titanic. She should be the concierge in The Godfather. Gerald McRaney as Barney Bucks, the dad, who's drinking them eggs.
Oof. Solid mustache, just saying.
You were saying, like, it's interesting that he never got those eggs in there because that mustache went down below his lip.
Yeah, like, it's just, like, really intense mustache game.
He's the only actor that I know from other things. Because his later career is, do you need somebody to play an army general? Call Gerald McRaney. He will, there is a movie where he plays a guy named General McRaney. Because that's just how typecast he is.
All right, we have Moses Gunn as Chiron. He was the person who sent Atreyu on his way. He was like, what are you doing here? We need a warrior, not some 13-year-old boy.
Oh, Judgmental Wizard Man.
I loved Judgmental Wizard Man's voice.
weapons.
That's because
alone.
He wanted the child to die.
All right, then we have Alan Oppenheimer, who was the voice of Falcor, Gamark, the Rockbiter. That's the rock dude's name. And he's also the narrator at the end of the movie, although he doesn't get official credit for that.
Well, and you said, what else does he voice?
He is Vanity Smurf.
That's not what I'm asking.
Denied twice.
He is Man-at-Arms.
Come on, Ryan.
He's Skeletor.
Woo!
But none of the voices in this movie are particularly Skeletor-ish, sadly.
But also good on him, because he saved that one. Yeah. That him keep that in the tank for later.
Oh, he was doing Skeletor at the time.
Yeah, but he didn't cross the stream.
Yeah, that's a sign of a good voice actor.
We do need a redub of this movie, though.
With Skeletor?
Every adventure needs a luck dragon!
And then we have Thomas Hill as Carl Conrad Coriander, the bookseller. Also the only actor who shows up in any of the sequels.
Oh yeah, that's right. He does show up in at least part two, right?
Yeah, he's in the second one.
When did the second one come out? 10 years later?
Not that far, but yeah, pretty far.
Does he taunt the boy that he's trapped inside of a book? Like the end of an Are You Afraid of the Dark episode?
Oh, no, the movies do change that aspect. Bastion does not end up in Fantasia by the end of the second movie. He has to get over his fear of diving, and he dives into a waterfall, and that's how he escapes Fantasia.
Does he come home before going back to Fantasia, or is that before he comes home? I haven't seen it in a long time.
The movie version is he goes home first, and then
that's
he goes back.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Isn't there, like, an evil witch lady who's like, use a wish?
Yes.
Wishmaster.
Give me power!
Weirdly enough, since this is a movie directly marketed to children in 1984, there was almost no merchandise produced to promote Neverending Story.
Where's my Falcor?
There are some PVC dolls that were fairly popular in the Europe, but that was it. Even to the present day, which is weird because this is a beloved cult film among Gen X and elder millennials, and we like to supplement our inability to become stable homeowners with nostalgic toys. Stuff. Like, this is a vein you could be hitting.
Well, Disney doesn't own it, so there's your first problem.
There is lots of unlicensed stuff floating around Etsy. People like to refer to those dolls as fake-ors.
I want a fake-or!
Well, you can get one for $10.
That's cheap!
The closest thing we have to a proper, officially licensed video game is a text-based adventure, like a point-and-click thing and typing stuff in, that was released for the Commodore 64 in 1985.
Oh, the old Commodore.
I mean, we're not that old. That was way before our time. As we already mentioned, there were some sequels, The Neverending Story 2 in 1990. This one loosely pulls in a few unused bits from the second half of the novel, but not really. It barely made back its budget in the United States, but it was a huge-ass smash in Europe, so it basically repeated what the first film did.
Well, it made back its budget, so technically it's not a flop.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't include, like, you know, marketing and distribution costs. But once again, it barely made back its budget in the United States, but more than made up for it overseas. That brought about The Neverending Story 3 in 1994. This one is not even pretending to care about the book, but it is interesting because the bullies in this one are being led by a very young Jack Black. It is weird to see the guy from Tenacious D as a teenager who's dressed up like what a 1994 German movie director thinks a punk looks like.
Is that around the same time he's on The X-Files?
Was Jack Black on The X-Files?
He is, in the episode DPO. I think Neverending Story 3 would have come first.
Ryan, did he look like the punk in Star Trek 4 playing the loud music on the bus?
He had a shaved head.
No weird spiky mohawk.
No weird spiky mohawk. A year after Neverending Story 3, there was Neverending Story the Animated Series, which ran for 26 episodes from 1995 to 96 and was produced by Nelvana. This one cherry-picked stuff from the books that it liked and then made up its own shit afterwards. This was also the year that Ande died. So, you know, he succumbed to stomach cancer and he hated everything that I mentioned already.
Damn.
I was gonna say, did all of this kill him?
No, he died of natural causes. Next up is Tales from the Neverending Story in 2002. This is produced by Muse for HBO, and it was 4 2-hour movies or 8 1-hour movies if you were watching it in the UK. This surrounded Atreyu coming to the human world.
What?
I've never heard of that.
I also didn't know about the cartoon.
Warner Brothers tried to kickstart a remake in 2009, but there are many legal issues. Nobody's entirely sure who owns the rights to what, and this project was abandoned in 2011. As of this recording, multiple studios and streaming platforms are engaged in a never-ending story bidding war with Ande's estate.
Never-ending bidding war.
I figured you were going to do that, so I left you some space.
How much money do you think they had to pay to put the song in Stranger Things, if nobody knows who's in control of the estate?
I couldn't tell you. The song is probably different. Lots of moving parts here. But anyways, that brings us to themes. The first thing, and only thing I wrote down, was the never-ending story as baby's first postmodern film.
I think that's fitting.
Maybe that's why I don't like it.
You don't like postmodernism?
I don't think so, no. I find it very boring.
So I was giggling just because what I thought this movie was about was, I was wrong. Like everybody in my life was like, no.
Postmodernism is a tricky philosophical concept to describe, as it's become a go-to bugbear for conservative demagogues who intentionally distort its meaning. For instance, one of Jordan Peterson's buzzwords is postmodern neo-Marxism, a label he brands everything he doesn't like with. This is a meaningless tangle of gibberish. Marxism is, at its core, a utopian perspective. It thinks that the world is corrupt and that they can fix it. Postmodernists are, by definition, skeptical of utopian perspectives. That puts Marxists and postmodernists at odds on most issues. Putting them together does not make sense. Marxists and postmodernists are, however, generally in agreement that oppressing people for immutable characteristics like race, ethnicity, national origin, sexuality, gender identity, or religious background is bad. Or at least, they're more likely to find these things to be bad than conservatives do. Many American conservatives define not hating trans people as extreme leftism, so they tend to think that Marxism and postmodernism is the same. But to put it perhaps too simply, postmodernism is a philosophical belief structure that argues that it's impossible for one person to have enough knowledge to develop a catch-all philosophical belief structure that works for everyone and everything. It rejects modernism, which usually positions that culture and society are progressing to an endpoint that will, one day, permanently solve our problems. An end of history, a theory of everything, a point where art reaches some kind of logical conclusion. Postmodern art is therefore critical of accepted structures and formulas. As such, it will, in some way, point out its own artifice. It will highlight its own seams in an effort to compel its audience to question how it was created and why it was created that way. And maybe it'll get you to ask those types of questions to the other things that you encounter. The most common form of postmodernism in an artistic sense is probably the fourth wall break, especially in performing arts. The thing about fourth wall breaks, however, is that they often don't mess with immersion as much as one may assume. People want to get lost in a fictional world. People want distractions. You know, say, think about how often Deadpool winks at you whenever you're watching one of his movies. If you're vibing with Deadpool, the break will only be momentary and you'll just pop right back in. This makes me think of a fact I read recently that throughout the 20th century, recent inventions that saved time, such as vacuum cleaners and dishwashers, were adopted fairly slowly from household to household, and it took a while for them to be ubiquitous everywhere. Whereas inventions that provided amusement, like radios or televisions, once those started catching on, they were everywhere after you blinked. The conclusion that a lot of people reach from that is that people want to fight boredom more than they want to reduce their workload. Like, it is that important to them. But yeah, getting back to postmodernism, I was just thinking about how Matt Groening reluctantly approved metafictional Simpsons episodes on the condition that the characters still act like themselves. Like, Homer, the fourth wall breaking actor, is still Homer, just like Daffy Duck remains Daffy Duck and Duck Amuck. Getting back to the Deadpool thing, as long as you don't break in a certain way, most people are along for the ride. And living in a media saturated landscape, and people are just sort of kept to the sort of thing now. The never-ending story, in some ways, at least by my interpretation, is a tribute to reader immersion. All books require the reader as a collaborator, and one must visualize the narrative in their mind as they go over the words. And for a lot of Gen X kids and elder millennials, the never-ending story was the first time they encountered something that was like poking at this and like, hey, look at what your head is doing while you're looking at this story and taking it in. Isn't that weird?
So, which I love. It's the best part about reading, is hallucinating. But what I thought this movie was about, I thought it was a metaphor for life. It was like helping kids figure out who they are and have confidence and understand that you can't save everybody. And
I think there's an element of that to it as well.
Everybody else, thank you, by the way. I appreciate that. You're the first person that was like, yeah, that's valid. Everybody else was just like, yeah, and you were wondering whether or not you had depression.
No, I mean, very clearly, Balthazar is told that he needs to find courage within himself. Like, the movie lays it out pretty plainly. He's running from the bullies, and the bookseller is like, well, why didn't you fight back? And the kid's like, I don't know. And at the movie's emotional climax, they're just like, you have to find the courage to give me my name. That is his character arc. And that loops into what you were just saying.
Yay, well, thank you. Ha, in your face, guy sitting next to me making me feel bad.
We're both just like, it's a metaphor for depression and grief.
Yes, it can be that too. We've discussed this enough times on the show. This isn't like hard Euclidean mathematics where there's a clear answer. We're in the humanities. You need to argue your point.
My current take here on this latest rewatch is I noticed a weird amount of parallels between the scene where, I mean, two scenes, where Atreyu seeing, like, the mural of everything he's done, and then when Bastion's talking to the childlike Empress, and she's just like, oh yeah, all this was supposed to happen. He was supposed to suffer, you were supposed to watch, blah, blah, blah. For some reason, on this watch-through, I was like, The Matrix 2, when the architect is telling Keanu that everything was bullshit. And he has to make a choice now to save everyone. I'm like, holy fuck, it's the never-ending story. She's the architect.
Okay, my most extreme comparison is the Junji Ito manga Uramaki. That makes me think of the never-ending story.
Do yes, tell.
The town that was possessed by evil spirals. One way to frame Uramaki is that it's about the futility of existence, in that everything just loops around and around and gets more and more severe as time goes on until it destroys you. And everything that you do to try to fight against it is futile. Nothing ever begins, nothing ever ends. It'll keep going and cycling around long after you're gone and there's nothing you can do about it. Like, that's essentially what Uramaki's about. It's a never-ending story.
Have you seen the movie, Ryan?
No, I've only read the manga.
Oh my gosh, the movie. It was my very first Japanese horror movie. It starts with, like, an old man poking at a snail, just obsessing with the shape of the snail's shell. And that's the start of the spiral. Just goes guru, 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 guru as he's poking the stupid snail.
So yeah, the spiral is kind of like the nothing, but there's no way to defeat the spiral. It's gonna get you no matter what you do.
So going back to like your comparison of that with the never-ending story, my dumbass didn't understand that the never-ending story like has an end. Like I thought the book itself was supposed to like go on and like that was the little wink at the end. I didn't understand that it was like, no, because he's reading the story that's happening and then you're reading his story.
And someone's reading your story.
Yeah, it's Citizen Kane walking at the mirrors again.
I know, but I didn't know. So, like, watching it as an adult, well, I mean, I only watched it as an adult, but I was like, that's clever.
All right, well, if that's everything I had to say about the never-ending story, is there anything that anybody else would like to chime in before we close things off?
Puppets! So many puppets!
Yeah. I mean, we haven't name-checked Henson's Law. Any CGI, no matter how cutting-edge, is going to look dated and terrible in 10 years, whereas cool puppets always look like cool puppets.
It's true.
Cool puppets!
I have a question. Do you think when Bastion is going, have confidence, Atreyu, and then the old man is also going, have confidence, Atreyu, do you think Bastion made him say it?
Yes. I don't even think that's subtext. I think that's stated text.
Yeah, so he was forcing the other man to be like, do it!
Yeah, Bastion is transforming the story as he reads it. That's just the nature of the plot.
Magic.
But hang on. So the old man at the beginning of this movie smoking his pipe was reading this story. Like, did he have an old man Atreyu?
Is he the reason that the nothing came? He set up the book for Bastion?
He clearly set up the book for Bastion.
He screwed over Fantasia just to give a child nightmares.
Do you think he made the Gamork?
I think he made the Gamork.
Nanu, Nanu. Thank you for listening, everybody. Good night.
This will show you for stealing my book.
Gamork for work.